The Management Myth: Why the Experts Keep Getting It Wrong. Author: Matthew Stewart. Accidental Consultant. Life is full of surprises, and this may be the best thing about it. Every surprise is an opportunity for learning. My career as a management consultant was a long list of learning opportunities. However, my experience contained a series of disturbing questions, which are the same questions that pushed me to write this book. Maybe the biggest surprise I encountered in the world of business was the feeling of déjà vu it inspired. The experts who are not experts, and the degrees that certify nothing but ignorance, where had I seen this before? In its best and worst moments, management reminded me of the subjects I thought I had left behind: philosophy. However, I discovered that asking the right question is more important than finding the right answers, and the biggest rewards go to those who can stay focused on one big thing that really matters. Moreover, I discovered that the true nature of management is humanity. The management idol. It is no coincidence that scientific management emerged in the same age that gave rise to scientific necromancy. Frederick Taylor's scientific solution to the labor problem was of a kind with Frederick August Baker's electromagnetic solution to the problem of evil. It was not science, but a simulacrum of science. It was, in short, an idol. The optimistic aspect of scientific management. Its view that conflict in the workplace would dissipate with the advance of science mirrored America's utopian conviction that progress would soon make happiness into universal law. Ultimately, the appeal of scientific management rested on its promise to supply a finale to the ongoing conflict between America's democratic values and its drive for economic modernization. How strategy became business. Strategy refers to a modern, professional discipline practiced by consultants in the elite departments of large corporations. Strategy took hold because it provided an intellectual superstructure that explained and justified the functioning of top management. It grew because it has represented the interests of consultants who served this new tier of management. It achieved permanence by furthering the institutional ambitions of the business schools, which expanded rapidly to serve the needs of the new corporations and their vendors. The strengths and limitations of the new discipline of strategy follow mainly from its institutional origins. Strategy, or strategic management, is now a thriving discipline, populated with a teeming multitude of theories, studies, and controversies. The business of strategy achieves its clearest expression in the shareholder value maximization model of management that dominates the business schools. According to this model, management alone knows how to make money, so the logical thing for shareholders to do is to hand all their cash over to management. Its chief consequence is to enforce students' belief that the only obligation they or their companies have to the rest of the universe is to pursue their own self-interest in the narrowest financial terms conceivable. An academic discipline of strategy, like the business school system from which it emerges, and the managerial perspective it represents, is fundamentally analytic, reductive, and risk-averse. By the default settings of all such institutions, it is bound to prepare people to become bureaucrats rather than entrepreneurs. We can, nonetheless, take some comfort in the knowledge that the core value of strategy will surely survive the academic onslaught. Striving for excellence. There are 8 attributes for successful companies. 1. Bias for action. 2. Staying closer to customer. 3. Autonomy and entrepreneurship. 4. Productivity through people. 5. Hands-on, value-driven. 6. Stick to the knitting. 7. Simple form, lean staff. 8. Simultaneous, loose, tight properties. The above-mentioned 8 lessons of excellence and success revolve around a single insight: treating people, not money, machines, or minds, as the natural resources may be the key to it all. Science of excellence. It seems unsportsmanlike to consider excellence as a piece of research, and yet it is unavoidable. The first obvious flaw in the method of excellence is that it provides no credible control group. Might there be companies that have applied the lessons of excellence and yet failed? Might there be companies that have applied none of the lessons and still succeeded? We will never know. The second and equally obvious flaw in the conception of excellence is an elementary confusion between correlation and causation. In framing their approach, authors assume that whatever attributes their excellent companies have in common are the same ones that can predict success in other companies. They fail to consider the logical possibilities that the attributes may have no causal relationship with excellence, or that they may be a consequence rather than a cause of excellence. If the methodological framework of excellence is problematic, the execution is arguably worse. The more important lesson to draw from the guru's underwhelming record is not that they fail to see into the future, but they are in a certain sense behind the times. If there is one idea that unites the gurus, paradoxically, it is that the conventional wisdom is dead wrong. They howl in unison, so if you want to succeed, you must break with the pack. The other important lesson is that the gurus are easy to prey on the all-too-human feelings of hubris. We all take more credit than we deserve for our successes, and we all blame bad luck too often when we fail. What makes the gurus different is that they are willing to extend the same holiday from reason to their pet companies. Excellence in business is about what works in particular time and place, not necessarily next year or the next town over. Any guru worth his multi-million dollar salt will tell you that the output is the only thing that matters on the job. It is not hours at the desk, but number of customers satisfied that counts, they will say. Future of management education. The first point to note is that management education confirms some benefits that have little to do with either management or education. Like an elaborate tattoo on an Aboriginal warrior, an MBA is a way of signaling just how deeply and irrevocably committed you are to a career in management. The degree also provides a tidy board of what sociologists call a social capital. Or what the rest of us, notwithstanding the invention of the Palm Pilot, call a Rolodex. The central insights of management theory are, in fact, the stock in trade of the humanities disciplines. Management theory, in fact, is already a branch of the humanities. It just may not know it yet. The questions that the management theorists raise and the insights that they offer belong not to a speciously practical discipline of management, but to the history of philosophy, and they should be taught and studied as such. By this definition, of course, a good manager is nothing more or less than a good and well-educated person. The best business schools will tell you that management education is mainly about building skills, one of the most important of which is the ability to think, or what the MBAs call problem solving. Nevertheless, do they manage to teach such skills? What they do not seem to teach you in business school is that the five forces, the seven C's, and every other generic framework for problem solving are heuristics. They can lead you to solutions, but they cannot make you think. Case studies may provide an effective way to think business problems through, but the point is rather lost if students come away imagining that you can go home once you put all your eggs into a 2x2 growth share matrix.